On today's episode of the Consumerism Commentary Podcast, John Graves explains his 7% solution for baby boomers who are close to retirement. Welcome to the Consumerism Commentary Podcast. I'm Jay Frosting. With me today is John Graves, the author of The 7% Solution. John, thank you for joining us on the show.
Well, it's very kind of you to have me here today. Thank you.
Am I right that your book is mostly for baby boomers who are worried about retirement?
That's a good observation, yes.
Okay. From looking at your website, it seems like you make what is probably a fair assumption about how baby boomers grew up in the 50s and learned certain lessons from their parents. What did they learn that maybe other generations didn't?
When we were kids in the 50s, we were raised by young parents who had just themselves been raised during the Depression and had fought or been Rosie the Riveter back home during World War II. And things were pretty tough for them. And they taught us from a tough background. They taught us four basic financial ideas that I take forward. One is the simple idea of living within your means. They taught us to live frugally. The second thing they told us was always save something from what you earn. My grandmother, my mother always had a coin jar in the closet where they would keep coins. My father always saved something from what he earned. And in my first job, as a paper boy and a seller of cards from door to door, if I made $2, I had to save 20 cents. The third lesson they taught us was debt is bad. It was very simple. I can recall conversations between my mother and father around the dining room table, and she wanted to know why, Jack, you think you can possibly afford $18 a month for that car?
Oh, boy.
We have subway. We have streetcar. What do you possibly need a car for? And you want to buy a house? Are you insane? They want $86 a month for a house? That's more than rent. So debt was the last and worst choice to their generation. And they taught us to be aware of debt and only use it when necessary. And the fourth and probably the most important financial lesson they taught us was tithing, giving back. Today we call it service. When the church plate passed, we always put something into it, and no matter how well off or poorly we were. So those four ideas, frugality, debt avoidance, saving, and tithing, I think stand us well as the boomer generation as we enter retirement.
Okay. But I guess throughout your career as a financial advisor, you've met plenty of people in your same age range that either didn't get those instructions or maybe left them by the wayside as they got older?
Yes. And as a result, they're less than well prepared. Yeah. It's interesting you bring that up. A firm called EBRI, the Employee Benefits Research Institute, every year conducts a retirement confidence survey. And the survey, pretty consistently for the last 23 years they've been doing it, shows between 60 and 64% of people who are boomers feel that they are doing a pretty good job of saving for retirement. That means that 40% are not doing a very good job. Mm. Interestingly enough, they also ask the same question to people who are retired. And those folks consistently respond 70 to 74%. They are enjoying retirement. They're not spending as much as they thought they would during retirement. Oh. And frankly, they wish they had retired earlier.
Wow. All right. So what are some examples of a person who hasn't been preparing correctly?
They have too much debt, too much credit card, and they don't have much put aside in their 401k or their 403b or their IRA accounts.
Okay. So how can these people afford to retire in your estimation?
Fortunately, those of us who are in our 50s and early 60s, first of all, have gotten the kids out of the house. They're in college and done, hopefully. And secondly, we tend to be in our peak earning years. So as a result, most of us have significant discretionary income.
Right.
As a result, if we haven't saved or have saved very little up to now, we have the ability through retirement plans at work to save a very significant amount of money. We could put aside as much as 25% of our salary or $49,000 each year So the caps are pretty high and wide. So even though we've waited too long, perhaps, that extra discretionary income and the ability and desire to save can allow us to fill up these retirement plans pretty significantly over the last 8, 10, 12, 15 years of working.
Well, that's good. When is it smart for people to start taking Social Security?
Most people feel a bird in hand is worth two in the bush, so take it at age 62 or at 66 when they're first eligible. And that's been a common theme for a long time. However, I would argue for waiting until as late as age 70 if you have other income sources to support you during those intervening years, because by age 70, your retirement benefit from Social Security will have gone up 8% each year. So it's like getting an inflation-adjusted 8% guaranteed government bond. So if you can afford to wait until then, the benefit is significantly greater. Well, the tax advantages can work to you. And if you have a good health and if you have other income sources, we suggest waiting until 70.
Okay. And what are some of the other income sources that you've come across?
People will have part-time work if they choose to. Interesting, going back to that EBRI survey, 90% of those people who continue to work after age 65 do so not because they must, but because they choose to. So we could choose to work in a part-time profession or in a giving back to the community in some format. We can also have rental income. If we sell a business, we may have income from the sale of that business, may have monies put aside in bank or savings accounts, and certainly in our retirement accounts. Under certain circumstances, we may have income from charitable trusts. We may have inheritances. So there's a wide variety of possibilities.
Mostly overall, it sounds like your recommendation is not to treat as inheritance as, you know, a happy, fun windfall, like, oh, I'm going to get that sports car I always wanted.
And don't count on it until the estate has been closed.
Good point. You talk quite a bit in the book about managing your own portfolio, and it seems like you're encouraging a lot of people to do that instead of paying others to do it. How much would a person save, and what do they need to know in order to manage it correctly?
If you're using someone like myself as a financial advisor, most of us charge an annual fee for our time, and that could be anywhere from 1% to 2 or 2.25% a year. And something like 85% of the financial advisory community use what are called financially manufactured products. Those would be mutual funds, exchange-traded funds, annuities, that sort of thing. Inside of those vehicles, the most popular, of course, are mutual funds. And inside of those vehicles, there are fees, there's expenses. And those expenses can be nominal, as in the case of an exchange-traded fund. They may only be 0.1 or 0.15% a year. Or they can be egregious. Some annuities are expenses are in excess of 4% a year. Some mutual funds have expenses in excess of 1.75% a year. So if you pay an advisor 1%, and if you're also using mutual funds inside that account, you could end up paying 2.5% or 3% a year simply for the joy of getting advice. Mm-hmm. That's expensive. In exchange, you would expect some sort of superior, not only service, but return upon your portfolio. And yet historically, over the last 30 years, less than 3% of all of the mutual funds, that's 14,000, less than 3% have even performed as well as the marketplace itself, the S&P 500. So the odds are stacked pretty severely against you actually performing as well as the market. So I would observe that if you're going to use an advisor, you should consider using an advisor for a variety of other reasons, not simply for performance. Second question you asked was, how would someone go about doing their own, designing their own portfolio? And that's really what the book is about. If you choose to do this on your own, you are, first of all, the type of person who is self-activated. You're comfortable working on your car. You like working in the garden. You enjoy cooking. Because the process of managing a portfolio, while not overly time-consuming, does require some amount of effort. It's not an easy, here's 7 quick rules, and you've done. It requires time and energy. So you have to want to give of that time and energy. So if you're that type of person, then the suggestions that I make are that you consider using individual stocks and individual bonds rather than financially manufactured products. And by doing so, you design a portfolio that meets your income need. So if you need to receive, for example, 5% each year from your retirement portfolio, you design the portfolio to meet that need. Mm. That's an entirely different order of suggestion than most advisors make. Most people say you need to have an asset allocation model. You need to have money in this account and that account and here and there and everywhere else. And I'm going to help you manage that. My suggestions turn that story upside down. Rather than managing a portfolio from the point of view of the market itself, I suggest you manage your portfolio from your own personal income needs.
When it comes to picking individual stocks and bonds, obviously a person's going to want to research companies before they invest in it. Are there some types of research that you recommend or kinds of industries that you think might be good for the next 20 years or so?
I have always tried to follow in the footsteps of a fellow by the name of Benjamin Graham. He wrote a book called Intelligent Investor, and he's always been a value investor. So back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, he spent months literally doing footwork trying to find information on individual companies. Mm-hmm. It took a long time, a lot of effort, and he was successful by looking for value-based companies. Today, because of the internet, because of computers, because of the availability of information to us, we can do what Benjamin Graham does very quickly on the internet. We could go to sites such as finviz.com or Seeking Alpha or investinginbonds.com, wickinvest.com. And with those types of sites, we can first of all learn before we step in. And secondly, we can discover, as you said, how individual companies, how they work, what dividends they pay, etc. And we can ultimately decide from that list of firms that we see, which may be appropriate to give us the income that we need for our retirement. So the significant part of the book discusses how to use a website such as FinViz, that's FINVIZ.com. How to use that to sort through and find companies that have what's called low price to book number, companies that have low debt, companies that have been paying dividends of 4, 5, 6, 7% and have been doing so for 5 or 10 years. And having created that short list of 20 to 80 different stocks, then going into each of those companies, going into their websites, learning to read their basics of their financial statements, and becoming more comfortable with actually making an investment by buying their stock.
Do you have an estimate for how much of the week or the month this might take up, somebody who's managing their own portfolio?
Well, it's sort of like cooking.
Okay.
I used to be a chef in my previous career, and anyone can make an omelet, anyone can cook a turkey, but the more often you do it, the better you become at it. Mm. It's like swimming. How do you learn to swim? You jump in the water, and you keep swimming until you get it right. So too with investing. It's not that difficult a process to discover, but it is one that requires a bit of effort. So my observation would be that 6 months to a year before you return, you're probably going to want to spend 5 or 10 hours a week in the discovery process, in learning about what you need to know, in learning about how to discover information on different firms, and in learning how to interpret that information as you see. And then finally setting up a sample or a model portfolio that you don't actually invest in, but you simply set up and watch. So you get the experience of seeing how things change, how prices change, and how this model portfolio that you've designed on screen to give you the type of income that you're going to want in a year, how it actually works in real time. So if you've been doing this for several months and teaching yourself through these types of websites and reading, etc., by the time you retire, you should be able to perform most of the tasks required to design and implement this portfolio.
Is there a certain type of personality that you'd recommend self-management for versus any other kinds?
The type of person who would do this best is someone who may have been self-employed or is in senior or mid-level management. Someone who's perfectly capable of making decisions and executing upon those decisions. Who's comfortable moving forward and taking responsibility for their decisions.
And it looks here that there's some sort of correlation between having a larger portfolio and this system working better as well.
a portfolio has to be of significant size so that it can give you the income that you need to support your lifestyle during retirement. So if you've got $50,000 or $75,000 or $125,000 saved up, that's not going to give you a whole lot of monthly income. Many of us boomers have very significant six-figure, low seven-figure accounts in our retirement plans. And those really are ideally suited to begin to generate the types of income that we're going to need during retirement.
Okay.
For example, if you have $600,000 in your portfolio and you need $50,000 or you want 5% from that, you're going to get $50,000 a year.
And regardless of anything else, you make a point also about a person's health being more important than anything.
Our health is far more important than our wealth. Steve Jobs is unfortunately the case that proves the point. The man was a billionaire. He had access to any and every level of medical care known to man in the 21st century. And yet he died a very young life of a very severe disease, pancreatic cancer, after having fought it for a decade. If we have wealth, that's lovely. But wealth in absence of health means nothing. So first and foremost, we boomers, when we retire, we really need to pay attention to our health. That means our personal health, our physical health, psychological, emotional, moral health. The healthier we are, A, the longer we're going to live, obviously, and B, we're going to be able to enjoy that wealth that we've accumulated. If that means changing our eating habits, if that means starting to take a walk during the afternoon, if that means having a glass of wine with our spouse that we've been living with for 35 or 40 years and talking outright and openly about things that we may not have discussed. Those are healthy attitudes. If that means letting the dog take you out for a walk each morning, that's good. If that means taking up a new sport, swimming, archery, sailing, badminton, bowling, craftsman, whatever. Not only does that give us physical strength and physical acumen, it also challenges ourselves mentally. Maybe we take up travel. We pick up a new language or a musical instrument, pick up a golf club or a bowling ball. Whatever it is, the healthy attitude, the healthy approach towards our retirement is going to make that retirement much more enjoyable than all the money that we've put aside. So I hate to get on a soapbox and...
No, it's okay. It sounds like a very good and important message, actually.
It truly is.
Are there any sort of leisure activities that you find are trending upward among retirees?
Travel certainly is. I would observe also that service has continued to be an interesting area.
Like volunteer work?
Yeah, volunteer work, exactly. Whether it's the church or synagogue, whether it's the community service, service corps for elders, whether it's going back to school and teaching, whether it's working with big brothers, big sisters, grandmas, grandpas, there's just thousands of different ways that we can give back. And that seems to be an aspect of our generation that we do enjoy helping others.
Well, that's good to hear. Thank you for writing the book and for joining us on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was John Graves, the author of The 7% Solution, You Can Afford a Comfortable Retirement. Learn more at theretirementjournal.com. Join us again next week for more great personal financial advice and information.
Thanks for listening to today's episode of the Consumerism Commentary Podcast. We welcome your feedback. Please email us at podcast@consumerismcommentary.com. To subscribe to the podcast or to listen to this or other episodes, visit us at consumerismcommentary.com/pod or search for Consumerism Commentary on iTunes. The Consumerism Commentary Podcast is hosted and produced by Tom Dubeck, Brian J. Bush, and Luke Landis. The music is composed and performed by Mindcube. The podcast was founded by Luke Landis.